We're beginning tape five with Dennis Surrett, Mike Smith interviewing Dennis Surrett on December 6th, 2001 at the Walter Reuther Library. You've taken us through the founding of CBTU in some detail, which was excellent. And we ended the tape, I think one of the last questions I had in the previous tape was, what were the accomplishments of CBTU, and you had ranged into a few areas. Maybe we can go back to that, and I'm trying to characterize the role of CBTU nationally and in the labor movement. And so if you could address what you think the accomplishments are, the driving forces behind CBTU, and then if you could bring it up to the present and okay. Where you think they're at.
Okay, in CBTU I was known somewhat as what they call a radical militant. You know, that's how I was characterized many times. I don't consider myself such. I certainly consider myself a person that is gave leadership to a chapter, a founding of the New York chapter in particular, for many years, and opened up a critical dialogue on many of the things that I thought were important, not only to the trade union movement, but to the black community. And in that period of time, the New York chapter brought to the national the position on South Africa, many of the struggles in Angola, Zimbabwe, which was Rhodesia, and many of the Central American struggles that were going on, and Caribbean struggles where people of color were fighting for their existence. I consider that a major piece of a contribution on the part of the New York chapter, which I was president of, to the national CBTU, in which we passed resolutions on at the national body, and were adopted. In my opinion, there would be no Schoenberg Library in Harlem right now without the efforts of CBTU New York. The curators came to us. They were getting ready to condemn the building where the in 135th Street, where it was housed. They couldn't, it was damaged beyond belief with valuable, works of Frederick Douglass and other original works of other noted African Americans that were being destroyed. The Carnegie Institute was threatening to take it all downtown. And when they came to us, we took the fight to City Hall. We took it to, at the time, Percy Sutton, who was the borough president. We have that struggle with Mayor Lindsay was the mayor. We made sure there was a community review once we had won a victory and got them to commit that they were going to build another Schoenberg Library, that there would be people from Harlem, black people, African-American people who were unemployed that would work on that project, both in demolishing the old building and also building the new building. We wanted to make sure there was an African-American engineer that was on this. And we won those things, you know, and eventually that did come to the community, and eventually the building was open. I feel very proud of that. We fought every struggle in the keeping hospitals open in New York, you know, Metropolitan Harlem Hospital, Sydenham Hospital, which was a huge fight, and some hospitals in the Bronx as well. The Emergency Finance Control Board, you know, which was an anti-union piece for the most part. We fought those folks and all. I mean, there was a march on Boston against racism because of what was going on in the 70s up there in Roxbury. CBTU led the way to tens of thousands of people in Boston to stand up to that racism. We led the way into the anti-Bakke movement, which was an attack on affirmative action, where we had tens of thousands of people in Washington, D.C. who marched against that particular ruling. So there were many, many accomplishments where when CBTU took the lead, we did lead, and we had the country following us, and we impacted labor as well. Certainly there were other issues around affirmative action and the question of seniority in labor that were highly controversial that obviously a lot of the top leadership couldn't live with, probably can't live with even now, you know, but I still think being a part of CWA and being director of education, I'm going to give some impudence to that particular piece on my side, you know, and I think we have some great arguments on it. But I think labor has gotten a little bit lazy and slow and complacent, and it might be, due to the fact that for too long, you know, we haven't stepped outside the box. And right now with Sweeney, who seems to be a decent progressive leader, you know, I can see where labor's taken a good turn. The fact that we've had a Bill Lucey around and had a Charlie Hayes around and a Cleve Robinson has been a good thing, you know, and Bill Simon and Oliver Montgomery. These are all good guys dedicated, you know, to the labor movement. Certainly fighting within the context of the box and sometimes a little out of the box. I guess I tend to be way out of the box at times, you know, but that's part of my political philosophy of understanding of how we make change in this thing. The CBTU chapter, which I know we brought a lot of pressure upon the Executive Council because of some of the New York CBTU chapter when I was president of it, brought a lot of pressure upon them to the point where I was being told by the likes of Leonard Bull and other people to cool it, slow down, and things of that sort. But these were on issues that we had adopted and adopted at our convention. But I have a feeling the heat was coming from upstairs, you know, on the levels higher than Bill was and otherwise, that we were out there too far doing too many things. So,
how large was the chapter at that point?
The chapter in New York almost reached 2,000 members.
And you were president from what during what years?
I was president from its founding in 1973 until 1978. And during that period of time, we had an educational department. We had many different forums, you know, when the members met, where they met international leaders and international struggles. And they were very advanced. We had a very advanced group, and we were very dedicated, and we worked very hard. I think that overall, as a matter of fact, we were acknowledged and recognized in 1975 by giving the first Malcolm X Award directly to a chapter. We were the Malcolm X Award recipients in that time, and I felt very proud because that was meant we were number one chapter in the country, mm-hmm. and they recognized it. But I think control might have been a factor here. The tail was wagging the dog a little bit. But I think it was very brave and very powerful, and the leadership had to do what they had to do, I guess, to ensure what they perceived at the time was the way that they could exist, and they certainly did exist for 31 years. And there were moves made to move my administration out in New York.
And moves by who?
It was moves by members of the Executive Council. They said it should be that we were too out there, we were too militant, and they made a move in about 77 to eliminate us as factors, you know, to slow down.
So in 78, then you lost your presidency of the New York CBTU chapter, but you stayed a member of CBTU. Could you tell us about your, I don't know if you, losing the presidency at that point, how that happened, or was it you, did you step down? Could you tell us about the circumstances and perhaps what you've done with CBTU up to the present?
Well, in 1977, there was a meeting that was called from the leadership in Washington, D.C., a meeting in New York about the New York chapter. I was not sent a notice. It was sent to certain people in New York that they were having a meeting at District 65 concerning the disposition of New York City, the viability of New York City as a chapter. And this is after we won the Malcolm X Award. It's the best chapter. And I was told about it by many members who called me up. And I in turn told my secretary to call a general meeting at that time because this is not going to be a private meeting by anybody without including everybody. And at that time I was red-baited and radical-baited and all that sort of stuff. And we turned them back. You know, they had to back up on that. The members stood up, and despite them showing flyers of me being on there with Angela Davis and other progressive causes that labor might have felt a little uneasy of, and to paint me red and black, the members stood up, and our chapter continued to prevail, and we continued on. But with the next elections that took place, we noticed there were many members who had not been regular members who had mysteriously joined the chapter, and when it came down to election, they put somebody to run up against me, and I lost by a couple of votes, you know. But I still maintained my loyalty to the chapter. You know, I felt bad that it had to be done this way. And then later on, because I was a member of the executive council as well, when the elections came in Memphis, Tennessee in 1978, they were running around a slate that was going to be run. My name was on the slate, and you know, there was nobody running against us. Anything that seems to be the way it is a lot of times in labor per se, but there was no new people running for the board at that time. And I was approached by several people that I had never seen before that had said that I should vote against Dennis Surrett. And of course, I'm Dennis Surrett. And I said, well, you know who he is, you know, and why, you know? They said, well, he's a communist, you know, he's radical, you know, and they gave me, and I had the slate in my hand. So I knew I was on the slate, you know, so I couldn't understand this until I looked at the slate, and it was an exact duplicate of the slate that I had, but it didn't have my name on it. So there, you know, that could be a joking thing. I went like, oh, so that's what's going on. And I was thrown off the executive council at that particular piece, and then later on I was, acknowledged from the stage, you know, for all the work that I've done, and I had lost that election, and given a standing ovation and all that sort of stuff like that. So, you know, they sort of applauded me a little bit out of the leadership there, you know. But I continued to go to meetings, and I continued to be a strong supporter of CBTU, because I felt that even though I thought, you know, that what was happening was not fair, you know, I didn't feel vindictive over it because I was involved truly with a lot of my CWA stuff and other struggles that I had involved myself in. And I still had the ear of the chapter itself. And about a year later, they had a dinner in my honor at the CBTU New York chapter, in which Bill Kane, Basil Patterson, one of the top people in New York, and Coretta, and a lot of it, and they gave me the Malcolm X Award individually, you know, and that was headed up by Joe LeBeau, who was the leading member of the chapter, and Leona White, who has passed away, you know, Webb, and, you know, a lot of good people in CBTU, you know, which has stated that they wanted to make sure I was on it, you know, correctly. And I did go to it, and I took it, you know, within the framework that it was. So I was active sporadically through the years with CBTU, occasionally going to a convention, talking with some of the leadership. I had turned my attention to a broader struggle with other black labor organizations that were fighting something more along the more militant line that I wanted to deal with, but I never condemned them in a way that you know, out of, you know, any kind of animosity, you know, because I thought the concept was too important, and that would reflect back in many cases, no matter what I felt like, you know, on what I felt very strongly about, that there should be a umbrella black trade unionist organization. The compliment comes very strongly in the fact that they did pick up on the South African piece a lot stronger, and are now the leading spokespeople in this country, you know, with Nelson Mandela and so to speak that. And they are recognized by the unions in South Africa as a major element, not only in South Africa, but in Central America and South America and the Caribbean and things of that sort. They have become an institution after all these years with high visibility and really some impact if they care to use it, you know, in various places. In my opinion, they have been a mildly activist organization. They haven't been near as active as I would have liked to have seen them be. I don't think they're a household word in the labor movement today. I think institutionally they're very recognized, you know, by the AFL and by other labor unions and things like that. But I think for the average worker, they're not seen as the godsend, the NAACP of the labor movement or anything like that. And members have grown a bit old. They haven't replaced, you know, we're all getting older. And like I said, I was a young Turk there, and there are many that are in the 80s and 70s that are good people. But we should have, CBTU, and I say we should have been mentoring younger people to step up in that. I think that's being recognized now more than it ever has been, which is a good thing. You know, so it's my hope, because I've been called upon, you know, by Bill, that we maintain communications through the years, you know, to come in and to help get this baby back on his feet. Of course, we don't have the same issues we had years ago when we bumped into each other on some things. I think what we're doing right now is he asked me to draw up an organizing plan. To go out and organize and to help CBTU expand and grow, which I've done. I presented that to the Executive Council in St. Louis last month. It was well taken. You know, I gave some very critical remarks around the fact that we don't have enough youthful people involved, and that we got to take a very serious effort to mentor more youth if we're going to have an organization that's going to continue, and that we've got to have some critical discussions of what would CBTU look like after Bill Lucy and all of those who are around today. Do we have adequate safeguards, issues, and you know, standing that we can continue to exist? Those are my present critical thoughts about CBTU. And I'm going to try everything that I can to inject issues outside of the box to interest more and more youthful people and trade unionists to get involved with maybe the plan that I threw out there, because that plan won't move without critical issues. I think any kind of plan, I thought I bought a great vehicle in with that plan, you know, that said regions should organize to a certain extent how they should do it, you know, but it won't move without gas. That car won't move without gas. And the gas are the issues. And if the issues are not out of the box to excite people, that car is going to stand there and the organization is going to die.
Well, what do you consider the critical issues that CBTU can get behind?
Well, there's a number of them. They're behind the election issues right now in Florida, which is great. And they're institutionally, you know, really beginning to stand up for some of those things. And they're standing up for a lot of issues today. But the difference is, you know, the statement you make and how far you get out there on issues. If you're going to say, yeah, I'm with that, and that's it, then, you know, you really haven't done justice to the issue. When you're an organization that has the kind of latitude geographically that CBTU has, I think what they have to do is do more organizing, active organizing, and demonstrating into the key areas, you know, and really advocating, you know, to the greater trade union movement around the interest of black workers. I think that they have used these institutions in a mild-mannered way to sometimes wrestle and get the things that they want, but they haven't excited the general rank and file of African Americans in the trade union movement. And I believe that we have to show a side, together with whatever they want to engineer on the inside, in the box. We have to show a side outside the box. I think the question right now that dominates things, in my opinion, that in the United States today, labor has moved and progressed in its lower and middle sectors in terms of organizing diversity within its ranks. You find more organizers, more staff people, you have more diversity at the bottom and all, but you have almost no diversity at the top.
You're speaking of the racial makeup of these levels.
I'm talking about the racial makeups of union. Now, how could it be, since 117 years ago, you know, that the AFL was started, that we haven't had, you know, a black as the head of a major union, you know, that exists today, you know, an industrial union, you know, such as the Big Five, you know, like CWA, my union, I could say, ASME, for example. I think those should have been the president of ASME, you know. I think the UFCW is another huge union, you know. I think the UAW should have had a black one, you know. So what happened here? You know, the question of, there has to be a button pushed here. We fought for diversity, and now we have diversity, and now the question is, what goes beyond diversity in as much as the top looks like it does? I think there should be a plan, a mentoring program of a sort that is inclusive of all races, you know, not only blacks, but Latinos, women's, and things like that, non-traditional people that have held this position before, you know, to make sure we have qualified people, not just put a color up there, but qualified people who are in the right place to have a chance at these higher jobs. This hasn't happened in labor. And I think that it's high time that something like an organization like CBTU step up and push the button and say, hey, guys, you know, we're going to start putting some pressure on you on this stuff. I think all unions should have a mentoring program where they have a number of blacks, women, Latinos, and otherwise that are in a program that can be looked at to, you know, to begin to succeed people. Because, believe me, I've looked at the democratic process in labor. Many national labor unions only have conventions once every 4 years, once every 5 years, and some every 2 years. I believe CWA, which my hat's off to them, they have a convention every year. They would like to have it every 2 or 3 years, but the members won't let them. But I think this would be a true test of democracy if they met more often and allowed members to be more involved in that particular process. If they began to mentor more people of color, you know, even if it was a pool of people or something like that, to make sure that they're known, to make sure they get credit, that the members know them from all over. But I've never seen a situation where anybody ever gave up power willingly anywhere. And I don't know whether that's really unrealistic to think of it happening in labor, you know, at this stage. Because once, you know, I think some of the best labor leaders and some of the worst will concede that they should have diversity, at least within their ranks. But they're not willing to give up their position for diversity, you know. And I think a lot of these guys are getting old, they're getting ready to move out. They've already tapped their buddies to step into their place. And sometimes these are not the most qualified people. And I think their qualifications should play it in there. And if they got some folks that are running around that are viewed at the labor echelon as highly qualified people of color, that they can dip into that pool and say, you know, here's somebody that can do the job. I'm going to give them a chance. I'm retiring. I'm leaving. You know, this is somebody I endorse. Then let, you know, if it's a seat that's up there, anybody runs for it, then let them run, you know, with that endorsement. Because what happens a lot of times, democracy does exist. And everybody in labor does have a chance to run. You know, not everybody, but mostly everybody in the major unions. But if the blessings go to one particular person, you know, if the executive council, executive boards give the blessings to one person, that person's going to win every time. So if someone leaving gives the blessing and says, this person is a good person, they should win, then we'll win. And we'll have some diversity at the top, and maybe we'll have other critical discussion going on in the labor movement to make it even better. I think that the labor movement is the vehicle that can drive us into this 21st century, you know, to really make things better socially for the entire country and begin to have a say, you know, even with many of our legislators who seem to be quiet in some heavy crisis times, even though they're friends of labor.
How would you characterize, if you can, organized labor? I mean, that's a rather broad term, but organized labor, the institutions of organized labor, their perspective and of CBTU and their perspective of how much clout CBTU has. How would you characterize that?
Well,
coming from the other end, I know.
Yeah. Well, I think that CBTU is considered in the box. They're not considered out of the box anymore.
They're considered an integral part of the whole labor apparatus. Approved.
They are very, very approved. They're not looked at as a radical element anymore. Bill Lucey is well accepted in the labor movement and well respected, for that matter. He does not constitute what I think a threat to the other labor leaders, so to speak. But they respect him because he could constitute a respect, you know, if, let's say, there are differences on some things. But up to this point, you know, in the general labor movement, he hasn't presented himself as a person that would not rationally discuss something within a box and get it resolved. He has excellent skills, negotiating skills that way, and he's relied on them over the years, and that's what he's done. Unfortunately, what happens is the outside doesn't see these skills. The bottom doesn't see these skills. They see a Bill Lucey that doesn't talk loud or yell loud when it's time to yell loud. There you see a Bill Lucey that's not leading major demonstrations and raising hell, you know, around things that in general, not just black trade unionists, but trade unionists would yell about. I think he appears at various things here and there, but CBTU is perceived as, an organization that, you know, certainly should be respected and is respected, but doesn't constitute the kind of threat that I like to see it represent. And I don't mean that, you know, being a flaming, you know, irresponsible, doing radicalized things or saying things that are irresponsible, but I'm just saying taking approach that would also, you know, sort of ignite rank and file members around key issues to move on. I had suggested, looking at their last resolutions, there are a number of resolutions, you know, that could be invoked using an organizing vehicle that might capture the imagination of a lot of people around the country and might help them to start to grow. I don't know whether this will work or not, you know, given the historical situation that CBTU has existed as a sort of a non-activist organization. But I don't mean that in a mean way, but I just think they've chosen to adopt that as a philosophical approach to helping trade unionists. You know, they don't, CBTU doesn't call national demonstrations on anything, it never has, but they do support a lot of the issues, but they attach themselves to it. They're not the leading edge of those particular pieces. You know, other organizations sometimes get the credit for leading the charge on that stuff. I'd like to see CBTU be the leader of a charge, you know, and I would like to see Bill Lucey walking at the front of the parade on a lot of these issues, you know, and making a difference on these kinds of things. I would like to see the mentoring situation much better than what it is today, and I'll help them work to that end.
Before we get near the end of the interview here, we've taken your labor career, I'd like to bounce back to that. We've taken you sort of through the 70s with Local 1101. I wondered if you could speak a little bit about your last few years at that local and then the move down to 2108.
Okay. Well, Local... Local 1101, while it is a dominant union in CWA, and probably commands as much respect as any other local anywhere, I served there for 5 years, you know, and was really intimate with all the problems and things of that sort. I certainly was fired more times than I should have been as an individual for taking principal positions, labor positions, issues concerning people of color, and gotten back my job, of course, and with some union help and with grassroots support. But I've stepped outside the box and I started getting involved with independent political action. I ran for president of the United States in 1984, and it was one of the most exhausting things that I ever did. Certainly I had the support of 5 independent parties from around the country, including Liberty Union out of Vermont, Consumer Party out of Pennsylvania, Labor Farm Party out of the Midwest, Peace and Freedom Party out of California and the New Alliance Party, which I had some problems with. But nevertheless, we staged it and I carried many of Labor's issues, you know, during that candidacy. And after that campaign, I was exhausted. I quite frankly, was totally exhausted. I had, you know, my kids that I was growing up with, my wife, Kathy, and I decided, I said, I just was so exhausted that it might be a good time to just stay home with my younger kids and my new marriage and just get out of things for a while. And I did that for a little while, and I transferred into Maryland. Unfortunately, there's no such thing as riding into the sunset on your burrow, you know, and thinking that you can take a rest or relaxation, because my history followed me into Maryland.
But when you transferred for Maryland, that was just nothing to do with union business, if I understand it correctly. It was just to take a position as a worker?
Right. When I transferred from local 1101 to Maryland, to local 2108, I came down as a rank and filer, and it was in the same company, you know, the New York Tel, but it was Chesapeake and Potomac at that time. And I soon after found that some of the people, I never talked about my history, I just wanted to work and sort of raise my kids, you know, which were young at that time.
What were you doing?
I was a splicer for the New York Telephone Company. I climbed poles and in all kinds of weather, in all kinds of conditions, and ran cable and those kinds of things. It was a pure labor job, believe me, you know. And I soon found out that my history caught up with me in the tune of my second level foreman, who was a strike breaker during the 71-72 strike up in New York and got his arms broken and his leg broken, you know, during that time. And he said, when I came down, he says, Surratt, he said, I know that name from somewhere. Well, he soon called up folks up there, and I was fired down in Maryland. And I acted, it was too late. I was there for about 6 months by that time, and I had known all the people, and I organized and got my job back, and I went after that foreman as a steward and then a chief steward, and I was back in the fold again, and eventually I became president of the local down here, which was the largest local in this district.
Why were you fired? Why were you fired?
Well, I was set up. I used to go out and work on placing telephone service in various areas. You know, this is brand new telephone service, splicing and all. And what they would do is send somebody, what they did was send somebody else out there revising the job, you know, and then they claimed that they came up with the plans and say, you didn't do this work, but yet we have a timesheet claiming you took credit for this work. And I said, when I kept the book of my own, and I said, well, I did do this work, and this is the date that I did this work. I was telling you about it. I always put dates and times on things. And it was, you know, and they, but that was just to come on with it. And then finally I found the people who they claimed, they wouldn't tell me who did do the work if I didn't do the work. But I found out who they were. And they said, no, that was already done when I got there. I just went out on revisions. And they stood up with me. I got my job back after a month, got my all payback. I demanded an apology. I got my apology, and then I became a steward. And then I says, you've just pulled the genie out of the bottle again. And I started as steward and chief steward, and then I became president of the local, and I kicked this guy's butt, you know. So back in the Maryland area, you know, I conducted one of the big strikes down there in Maryland as well, and I've helped to pull together the National Minority Caucus of CWA, and become very clearly got involved politically with most of the things that were going on, including police brutality things and all. And it just made it clear to me that you're never out of the struggle. The struggle is my life, and it's going to be until the day I die, until we start changing something. And there's no way to escape it except to cowardly, you know, take what they give you. And I'll never take what they give me.
What years were you president there?
I was president from 1997, beginning in 97, 98, 99. No, from 1997 to 2000, ended my term.
And what are you doing currently?
I'm currently, believe it or not, I'm the director of education for the International CWA. And I teach at the Meany Center, I write programs, I revise, you know, many of the documents that, you know, need revising because they end up dated. And I correct, in many cases, some of the historical things that were too accurate. And have joined a pretty wide family of educators around the country, you know, who are very progressive, who are of like mind, that I feel very comfortable with. And for whatever quick years I have, I continue to give that to the movement and to the struggle. And in this case, that I've gotten more involved with CBTU, I'm excited about helping to fire it up again and to, for it to have a much better voice than what it had before I got here.
What did you mean about correcting the history? That's something you might want to explain for this oral history. That could sound...
Yeah, well, in many cases, I've examined, you know, I'll be very honest, you know, I see... We were written out of history. African-American workers in CWA, as well as other unions, were written out of history. Latinos, the same way. I say I have to revise the history to write us into it. The way union, the line in union is though they always took the correct position at the correct time, and that's bullshit. We had to fight, struggle, scream, and to get everything that we needed, and we contributed to the building of these unions. And it's never displayed in a way where people of color can understand the contributions they've made. And I think that that's really important, you know, for a labor union to continue to exist and to service so many people of color, you know, from around the country, wherever their constituents may be, and act like it was just something that they did. I like the idea of critical dialogue and critical fights where they sometimes were wrong and sometimes were right, and I want to inject that into the historical perspectives of our union so it doesn't look like, you know, we walk the straight and narrow all the time.
How did you become director of education for the CWA?
Well, it's that's sort of a strange piece. Given how I perceive myself at times and how I'm perceived by others, you know, a lot of people thought I did a great job with the local that I had, you know, on the straight and narrow, and I did a lot of pieces, ran a great strike, and we won a lot of great benefits. And so I guess it was another look that the national CWA under the leadership of Morty Barr and Larry Cohen as executive vice president had what I was doing. And Larry Cohen, who's a new EVP, who's a very progressive Jewish man that has a great and colorful history coming out of Jersey in CWA, and probably one of the youngest national executives, you know, in CWA, executive vice president under Morty Barr, and perhaps heir apparent, you know, was around close to New York when I was doing a lot of stuff. And I took a liking to him because he's the kind of guy, he's not the vintage labor leader. He's a guy that always reminds you that this is the rank and file's money. He's a guy that doesn't like riding limousines. He puts a backpack on his back. He's probably an organizer extraordinaire. He has a great anti-racist position and, you know, anti-sexism and all of these kinds of things. And when a good organizer, a good guy. I endorsed him as an executive vice president at one of the conventions. And when I decided to come back to work, I looked into a series of places, including CSCA, and I was hired by CSCA. But I guess while they were calling around to check my credentials, they called CWA, and then I got a call from CWA to say, would I be interested in, you know, coming to work for them and taking that position? And of course, I said, conditionally, as long as, you know, I said, I think we should talk, because I certainly wouldn't want to embarrass wherever your line is, because I have a lot of strong convictions. And when I was told by Larry, I want you for you, and that I had access to him at any time, I thought that was favorable conditions for me to work under, and I had already thought well of him. But I would not have come back probably to work for just anybody, and I still think I can contribute things.
When did you start this job?
A year ago this week.
So really? So yeah. This would be December 2000.
Yeah, December 3rd, 2000, I started. And we've already started making some progress in a lot of areas. I've automated this. The education department is being automated, and there's a lot of changes we've made. I've run a couple of three-week courses, the Minority Leadership Institute of CWA, which is being called one of the most progressive programs that have been put on. And AFL is looking at it as something that they might want to copy and emulate. And this course included globalization pieces, every tendency that's in CWA, the gay, Latin, Asian, black, white, the whole piece there, you know, global issues, you know, class issues. And we've called everybody in on this thing for a three-week course. It's highly intensive. And it was a 9-credit course, you know, that people can use for their college pieces, and it teaches leaders. I was teaching leaders from all over the country, presidents of locals and things of that sort. And I got all 10s on that. So I feel pretty good about some of the work that I've done now, and that there's a lot more to be done. And right now I'm really focusing heavily on CBTU and hoping that if, you know, Bill and everybody is sincere about wanting to really get this baby moving, then I will do the best that I can, you know, to fire it up a little bit.
Yeah. Okay, we've kind of gotten through your career. I know there's probably another 4 or 5 hours worth we could speak about. But I want to step back again. It's, you know, anyone who studies political history of the United States knows that third-party candidates are a long shot, to say the least. There's only been a couple incidents where one could consider possibly a third party making a president, and especially considering that you were with very small parties. Could you explain your decision to run for president and what you thought you might accomplish during this?
Well, first of all, I never thought I'd run for president of the United States. I didn't go out with any idea, any weird thought, except maybe when I was a kid, and that wasn't even real, of running for president of the United States. I certainly have supported independent candidates in the past, you know, that were running on issues that I you know, Byron Commoner being one of them, you know. Certainly there's been activists that have run, you know, 30-party tickets. But I was, in 1983, I was notified after I had worked with elements of the 1972 National Black Assembly, and they were putting together an organization called National Black Independent Political Party. And I worked within that from 1980 until about 1982, when it was clear that it was dissolving. You know, it wasn't working in terms of a political element for, you know, people of color as a third party, so to speak. And then I was called in 1983 by the Consumer Party of Pennsylvania. And they indicated to me that they were looking for a candidate for presidency. And I said, you know, I kind of laughed at him. I said, it was really nice. It was Max Weiner. He was the chairman of the Consumer Party at that time, and a few of his aides. And he says, well, let me tell you this. He says, I have already checked around the country. And he said, there's an independent party up in Vermont run by Peter Diamondstone, you know, who likes the idea as well. And I've also talked to the Labor Farm Party, and they are also interested in you being our candidate, you know, Barry Commoner, you know, we would very much like. So it was like an incredible call, and I just said, well, I don't quite know what the Consumer Party stands for. You know, I guess we'll have to talk about it a little bit. And I didn't take it serious, you know. And I just kept getting these calls, and then this New Alliance Party called me as well, you know, and I had interacted with some of the people that were running. But I wasn't very close to them in any kind of way at that time. And discussion ensued, and pretty much next thing you know, I was invited to various conventions on issues. They wanted to know my issues, and I raised a lot of labor issues out of things, and environmental issues that I was definitely in agreement with, and we were very, very, very compatible on these things. And in no way that I could win an election, but perhaps I can give a platform for it. But I also knew that year that Jesse was thinking about running, 1984, Jesse Jackson. And I notified some of his people as to whether he was running on this thing because, you know, there and how he was running. Would he ever consider running as an independent? And they said, yeah. You know, so I said, well, that's great. You know, I said, I'll give these people his name. You know, Jesse is obviously, he's going to pull millions of votes on this thing. So there was some talk around there, but in order to get on a ballot in the States, you've got to run. You know, so if he was running as in the Democratic primaries, he couldn't run in the independent primaries. So I sort of ran with the idea that perhaps by the time Jesse, if he didn't get the nomination, you know, he would go independent. And I could pass off the votes to him, you know, all my states to him, you know, and he would be the candidate, and he could run as a third-party candidate and really impact this thing. Well, and so I was crisscrossing. It was a hell of a campaign all over the Deep South, ran into a lot of, that's a story within itself. And and then the Democratic Convention came, and Jesse decided that he would vie for a part of the platform. He made his very emotional speech about being somebody. And we knew, I looked at that speech, and I knew he wasn't going to run as an independent. And so it was up to me to run to November. And at the same time, you know, not to appear as though I'm running against Jesse Jackson, you know, but to try and spirit some of that Jackson energy into my campaign, you know. And I made a point. I says, you know, you don't have Jackson in November, but you got me. You know, Jesse has never run in November, but I am, you know, that kind of stuff. And it was a hell of an experience, you know, getting on the ballot of every state and finding out really what the pluses and minuses are for third-party candidates and taking the issues, you know, into small towns in the South and into the big cities and into the West, you know, being exhausted for days without sleep, you know, all of that stuff. That was a microcosm, and I thank all of those independents that rallied around me, and I went to each convention and was, you know, was approved by all of them in their constituency, and the monies that they put up, you know, which was a relatively small amount of money, a few million dollars, you know, when you add it all up into what everybody was contributing, you know. But like any other campaign, especially from the left, you know, you can make 3 million go as far as 20 million, you know, because of the work that you do. So what I did was take a leave of absence from the job, you know, because I was still working at the time, and took all my vacation time, and on weekends, you know, I would be taking visits to different parts of the country. And it was good because the National Black Communications Coalition, which was still around in 84, they endorsed me, and I got a lot of other endorsements from friends, you know, and organizations alike. And it was a great experience.
How many votes did you get?
Well, I like to say I came in third. That was the year that Mondale ran, and Mondale got one state. And I came in behind Mondale, you know. But it wasn't a lot of votes. I don't even remember. It wasn't even a million votes, you know. But it was like I said, the general idea and character of it. And believe it or not, man, everybody remembers me for that campaign. Oh, yeah, you ran for President of the United States. And I think that it was a great experience. You know, it certainly enhanced my horizon a lot more than what it was before, mm-hmm. You know, and I still managed to stay, you know, and stay the same person that I am today. So I guess I have my name etched around a little bit now, you know. So it's more than enough time for me to give something back.
Yeah. If you quit tomorrow, quit political activity, quit your job, how would you like to be recognized?
I would just like to be recognized as somebody to put ego second and put my struggle and ideals and ideas first and worked real hard at it and helped to enlighten a lot of folks in terms of the things that they should do on critical issues, going against bullshit being someone that just spoke up when it was time to speak up, and hopefully have mentored enough people who I have about 10 people I'm mentoring right now from around the country who I talk to on a weekly basis around political things to help shape their agenda in their areas to do it a lot better. And maybe remembered as somebody that helped to build a lot of organizations that did some good, and that hopefully some of these organizations can serve as a model, you know, for others to come forward and get involved with.
And before we end this session, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I don't know much more I could add other than the fact that I never did anything by myself. And I think more than anything else, I get a lot of credit for a lot of stuff. And there's a lot of people whose names nobody will ever know, you know, who I've come across over the years that I've been overly impressed with, you know, that are just Joe regulars who never thought they could change anything, and together we changed a lot of things. And a lot of these folks, just send a message to these folks that you can change anything, you know, that you feel need to be changed if you have the will to do it. And that's the model that we went through, and we changed a lot of different things, even with people who never ever thought they could change anything. But when they came together, brought their heads together, and really tried, we did change some things. And that at any time you fight for something, never forget that you have to keep an organization together to hold it.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.